Welcome to the first episode of the podcast, The New Yorker Political Scene. My name is Russ Finkelstein, and besides having a reason to glorify the sound of my own voice, what I'm hoping to do is go over what is being talked about on The New Yorker's podcast, The Political Scene, which is, of course, one of this great nation's foremost journalistic institutions, and which regularly puts out some of the dumbest, corniest takes on the news from people who are likely making multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably more than that, for sharing their thoughts with the world. The New Yorker Political Scene is a podcast hosted by writers Jane Mayer, Susan Glasser, and Evan Osnos. They are a group of egg-headed Washington insider types who really do pride themselves on their Washington insiderness and their egg-headedness. If you're like me, you might hate listen to this podcast somewhat regularly and wish you could inject some sense and reason into their conversations. So that's basically what this is. I think it'll be fun. Hopefully it'll also be a place where we can come together and feel a little less insane. I've been working as a journalist for the past 15 years or so, and I have a lot of friends who are journalists. If you're listening to this, there's a pretty good chance that you're one of them. To you, I say, come on my podcast. I'd love to have you come on, talk about your work, and of course, help me mock and deride the New Yorker political scene, which I'm sure is a smart career move for me and for you as we ride this sinking ship to the bottom of the ocean and beyond. So let's get into it. This week's cold open was in reference to the state visit of Kenya's President William Ruto. He was hosted by President Biden at the White House. There was a lot of pageantry around this visit. The red carpet was rolled out. There was celebrity guests. There was extravagant food. But what most caught the attention of the political scene, of course, was the visit made by America's most dapper former president, Barack Obama, who stopped by the state dinner wooing the guests and apparently also the host of the political scene.
Can we talk about the ultimate drop-by? So, okay, there's a state dinner. There's really only one person I know who can just drop in.
I've
and
never
drop
heard
by,
of a drop-by.
Yeah. Barack Obama.
Here's my question. So he drops by the state dinner with
what is
the
he,
Kenyan
what
leader.
Else is he doing?
So where does he go after that?
Exactly.
What is he like, oh, I'd love to stay, but I got to...
Also, he was wearing a tuxedo, which I noticed, like, if it's a drop-by... And no, Michelle Obama. This is very interesting. Obviously, Barack Obama is the only president in American history who has Kenyan roots. We're giving a state dinner for the leader of Kenya.
Yeah.
They need to give us a little bit more explanation.
I think you need to take the rest of the day and do some reporting on this, frankly.
Yeah, Jane, I think you can get to the bottom of anything.
Honestly, I think it is the ideal way to go to a state dinner.
Drop by,
but gotta go. And then, 25 minutes later, you're in your pajamas.
I noticed that. Enjoying life.
You know, who wants to really be there all night anyway?
For the fifth course. I noticed that Bill and Hillary Clinton were there, and they didn't drop by. I think they stayed from the first Ritz-Carlton to the last aperitif.
That's very Clinton, though, isn't it?
Exactly.
He was always the last person to leave the room.
So it's funny that it ends there with that discussion of Bill Clinton. I don't know if that's a reference to the fact that Bill Clinton was a sort of party animal and a womanizer and a alleged sexual assaulter and a philanderer and all that. But it is ironic in a way that Bill and Hillary Clinton in particular were invited to the state dinner, given the context that as the state dinner is taking place, Kenyan police are arriving in Haiti in a U.S.-backed operation to try to reestablish order in Haiti. And for all of the history of the Clintons in Haiti in particular, I think it's sort of interesting, and we'll get into that in a bit. So now, reading from an Associated Press article, President Joe Biden on Thursday expressed a deep appreciation to the Kenyan President William Ruto for the coming deployment of Kenyan police forces to help quell gang violence in Haiti, and he defended his decision to withhold American forces from the mission in the beleaguered Caribbean nation. The United States has agreed to contribute $300 million to a multinational force that will include 1,000 Kenyan police officers. But Biden argued that an American troop presence in Haiti would raise, quote, all kinds of questions that can be easily misrepresented. Interesting. I wonder why they would be so easily misrepresented. continuing on here, Biden presses his appeal to African nations that the U.S. can be a better partner than economic rival China. Beijing has been deepening its investment on the continent, often with high-interest loans and other difficult financing terms. The White House announced $250 million in grants for the International Development Association, part of the World Bank, to assist poor countries facing crises. Separately, a $1.2 trillion government funding bill passed by Congress in March allows the U.S. to lend up to $21 billion to an International Monetary Fund trust that provides zero-interest loans to support low-income countries. An Associated Press analysis of a dozen countries most indebted to China, including Kenya, found the debt is consuming an ever greater amount of tax revenue needed to keep schools open, provide electricity, and pay for food and fuel. So that's really what's going on here. That's the backdrop of this state visit. It's the reason why the red carpet is being laid out for Kenya's president. That is the purpose of it, is to distract people from thinking too critically about the fact that the United States is spending all of this money on the one hand to counter China's influence in places like Kenya, and also to pay for a country like Kenya to send its young people into harm's way in a place like Haiti, so that the United States itself doesn't have to do it. According to the Associated Press, attendees of the state dinner included country singer Brad Paisley, singer-songwriter Don McLean, author Barbara Kingsolver, former Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, her 16-year-old son, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, who took his mother, Al Sharpton, actor LeVar Burton, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, actors Wilmer Valderrama, Sean Penn, and Michaela Cole, and NBC News anchor Lester Holt was there, former Top Chef contestant Kwame Onwuachi, and top Democratic donor Mark Gallagher was there, Sheryl Sandberg, Melinda Gates, Hunter Biden, and Bill and Hillary Clinton. This is from a Guardian article in 2019. Over their many decades of involvement there, the Clintons became two of the leading proponents of a particular approach to improving Haiti's fortunes, one that relies on making the country an attractive place for multinational companies to do business. They have done this by combining foreign aid with diplomacy, attracting foreign financing to build factories, roads, and other infrastructure that, in many cases, Haitian taxpayers must repay. Hillary has called this economic statecraft. Others have called it a, quote, neoliberal approach to aid. The most significant test of this approach in Haiti began on the 12th of January 2010, when a magnitude 7.0 earthquake struck just west of the capital, Port-au-Prince. In a nation of 10 million people, 1.6 million were displaced by the disaster, and as many as 316,000 are estimated to have died. The earthquake also dealt a huge blow to Haiti's economic development, leveling homes and businesses in the most populous area of the country and destroying crucial infrastructure, including the nation's biggest port. Within days of the earthquake, the Clintons stepped up to lead the global response. Bill was selected to co-chair the Commission Task Force with direct relief spending. As U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary helped to oversee $4.4 billion that Congress had earmarked for recovery efforts by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. At every stage of Haiti's reconstruction, fundraising, oversight, and allocation, a Clinton was now involved, Jonathan Katz, a journalist who covered Haiti for more than a decade, wrote in 2015. And of course, what happened since then was there's been a lot of criticism of the Clinton Foundation and other foreign aid organizations and efforts in Haiti, because all of that money that was put in Haiti effectively, it did not address some of the very serious problems that they face in Haiti with infrastructure, with governance, and in essence, a big problem that's that it's contributed to and that continues to be the case to this day is that the people of Haiti ultimately have no say in how those resources get spent or allocated. And a lot of these organizations and aid workers and operations are sort of very top heavy, meaning a lot of that money is going to pay substantial salaries for aid workers or executives or administrators who are, you know, doing things like fundraising or logistics, and are paid a lot more than what a Haitian person would be paid to do the same work. And then, of course, there's no democratic check on where those resources are put. So let's say, for example, the Clinton Foundation decides a school or a hospital or something should be built in a certain area. The people of Haiti, who normally would have some sort of democratic say in how their country is developed or governed, that authority or that democratic check is taken away from them because of all the influence of all of this money. One of the political issues in Haiti that had sparked unrest in previous years was the minimum wage. And the Clinton Foundation and the Clintons in particular supported political candidates who were opposed to raising the minimum wage. And this caused destabilization there, and it caused basically the type of outside influence in elections and in Haitian politics that, if it were happening in the United States, the hosts of the New Yorker political scene would be very critical of. That's the sort of involvement that the Clinton Foundation and other international aid organizations have had in Haiti. Of course, the New Yorker political scene either has no knowledge of this, or it's not within their purview, or they're not really interested in discussing and getting into these things. They'd really rather discuss how cool it is that Barack Obama stops by the White House, and how cool of a guy he is. And that's sort of, that is their frame of reference. That is the milieu that they belong to. And that is the sort of scope of their analysis when it comes to things like this state dinner, which, as we're discussing, has a lot more substance to it than simply like a fancy guest list of a bunch of celebrities and the appearance of America's coolest former president. Moving on, after the cold open about the Kenyan president's state visit, the political scene hosts go on to discuss political discourse in this election year and foreign policy. Have a listen.
Over the past several weeks, much of the political discourse has been consumed by the goings-on inside a New York City courtroom. But the world outside that courtroom hasn't stopped. In fact, we've recently seen a variety of dramatic international developments. These are things that would have dominated our conversations in any other year. Things like the sudden death of Iran's president, the meeting between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, and the worsening situation in Ukraine, to name just a few. Yet the Biden and Trump campaigns haven't focused much on foreign affairs and policy. They've taken a backseat to domestic issues like reproductive rights and the economy. But these recent global events deserve serious attention.
Now, is that really true? I follow the news. I'm assuming if you listen to this podcast, you might follow the news quite a bit as well. Everywhere Biden goes during a campaign event or otherwise, he's shouted at by protesters. There's been a lot of discussion, and his campaign has had to respond to allegations that his administration is complicit in a genocide. There's concerns over whether the U.S. support for Israel could jeopardize Joe Biden's chances in November. There's been a lot of discussion from Donald Trump, as the same podcast that we're discussing gets into. They'll talk about later in the same episode about Donald Trump's rhetoric as it pertains to Russia and Ukraine, and the disparity between Joe Biden and Donald Trump's positions on Ukraine. So I just don't really think it's true that foreign policy isn't getting enough discussion In this political cycle. I'm not really sure where she's getting that.
You know, what's happened in the last few years with Iran is kind of the story with a lot of America's adversaries. They've dug into their positions. Perhaps they've seen weakness in our own internal divisions. They have actually started working together much more closely. And that's where, you know, this word axis is almost like a forbidden word in American politics.
Yeah. It is triggering.
But the truth is, perhaps you could argue that back when George W. Bush used that word and talked about a quote-unquote axis of evil, that it was either premature or unfounded. But now there is actually increasing evidence to suggest there really is, if not an axis, a nexus, very much as you pointed out, Jane, between China, Iran, Russia, and these major conflicts that are destabilizing the world today, whether it's Russia-Ukraine or in the Middle East. Iran is at the center of that, providing weapons, drones to Russia, and becoming, in fact, an increasingly important supplier of those weapons. At the same time, obviously funding proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis that are actively engaged in conflict with U.S. allied forces throughout the region.
So she says there's increasing evidence that there is an axis. Does she mean an evil axis? That was the context in which the quote-unquote axis was discussed, that she's referring to there as the evil axis, because George W. Bush sort of saw the world as, like, you know, different teams, good versus evil, and the United States, of course, being the side of good. And in that framing, the axis would be the quote-unquote evil axis that she's discussing here would be China, Iran, and Russia. So it's interesting. It's an interesting sort of framing to embrace or adopt. And I wonder if she would also apply such a frame to the nexus that's taking shape or that's solidifying between the U.S. and Israel. And Israel, who's now facing charges of genocide at the International Court of Justice, and whose prime minister and defense secretary are facing similar charges at the International Criminal Court. Is that an axis? Is that a nexus? One might say, you know, she's talking about how Iran is aiding and abetting all these groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis who are engaged in, quote, conflict with U.S. allied forces throughout the region. You got to extrapolate a little bit and wonder if, you know, you do believe in human rights, you do believe in things like international law and the rules of war. What does that say about the axis that the United States is participating in and involved in the region if we're aiding and abetting alleged war crimes in Gaza? But of course, the framework of a nexus or an axis would only ever be applied by the hosts of the political scene to U.S. adversaries, not to the United States itself. And another thing that it makes me wonder is if this axis that's being discussed, Russia, China, Iran, it makes me wonder if it perhaps is not emerging thanks in large part to U.S. policy around the world. Let's see what Susan Glasser has to say about that.
You know, there have been all these memes that I have to admit I've been following online on social media after the helicopter crash, you know, images by artists of the women of Iran and their hair pulling down the helicopter. It is an extraordinarily, not only is Iran an extraordinarily repressive society, but in some ways, Xi and Putin are sketching out a future of a kind of techno-authoritarianism that unfortunately has given all of these regimes incredible new powers that in some ways they could have only dreamed of back when Putin came to power more than 20 years ago.
Yet, when you think of them as being techno-authoritarian, part of the reason I gather that the helicopter crashed was it had such completely backwards kinds of engineering. It was something that dated back
to the... It was an ancient American Vietnam-era helicopter from the era
of the Shah, and partly because of the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran.
No, that is, in some ways, the takeaway from it is it's a measure of Iran's isolation. You know, they were flying on a helicopter that literally hasn't been manufactured in years. And Iran was quick to blame the United States, to say it was this sanctions regime that prevents us from being able to maintain our plane. It's America's fault.
Of course. The great Satan, of course. Again.
But I think isolation and xenophobia, and that is one of the themes, and we'll talk about it more, that unites these powers.
Well, first of all, I just think it's interesting that Evan Osnos there injects this idea that xenophobia is somehow one of the galvanizing ideologies or something that sort of binds this nexus of evil together. I'm not really sure what he means by that, and I have listened to the entire episode, and I don't know. He doesn't really come back to that idea of xenophobia, but yeah, I guess it's a handy way to sort of cast aspersions on China, Russia, and Iran. I mean, I'm not saying that those countries or societies or their governments don't have like xenophobic tendencies. Xenophobia is like obviously a streak that runs through a lot of different societies and cultures, including the United States. I'm not sure like what role xenophobia has in informing like China's strategies as they pertain to Russia and Iran. I'm very curious what he means, and I would love to hear more about that. Jane Mayer says here that the helicopter crash happened in large part because of, quote, completely backward kinds of engineering. And they sort of joke or like sort of laugh at the fact that the helicopter crashed because it was a relic from the 70s or the 60s. An American Vietnam era helicopter, they call it, from the era of the Shah. And in large part, Iran, they acknowledge that in large part, Iran is using this sort of helicopter because of the sanctions the U.S. has imposed. So it makes you wonder if this axis that's emerging between Russia, China, and Iran isn't fueled in part or accelerated because of U.S. policy, including U.S. sanctions. I'm reading here from a New York Times article dated 2018. Trump abandons Iran nuclear deal he long scorned. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA deal struck by Obama in 2015, Trump pulled out in 2018, and France, Germany, and Britain remained in the deal with Iran. Many at the time said the U.S.'s move would empower conservatives in Iran who were skeptical of the West. So there you have it. A lot of the economic pressure on Iran and the fact that the United States basically signed this agreement that would have completely activated Iran's economy and allowed Iran to trade with the West, basically. Donald Trump reneged on that deal, and as a result, the country politically was driven further into the position of conservatives and hardliners in Iran who are skeptical of the West, and they've suffered economically as well. And U.S. sanctions have repeatedly shown to have the opposite effect of what their intent is purported to be. Look what's happened in Cuba. Look what's happened in Venezuela. Economic sanctions in those places cause shortages of all sorts of goods, exodus of migrants, shortages of medicine, and basically none of the meaningful changes that the United States advocates for, besides maybe some failed coup attempts here and there. So the fact that the hosts of the political scene sort of mock the idea that Iran would blame the United States in part for this helicopter crash is sort of sad. I mean, it just shows their lack of ability to think about the world and to think about other countries from different points of view other than the point of view of the United States. And it's funny, too, because I know Susan Glasser lived in Russia for a long time. Evan Osnos lived in China, and they reported in both of those places, but it just seems like they're so trained and rewarded for constantly seeing the world through the lens of the United States, they're just not able to ever imagine how it would feel to be Iranian and to celebrate a deal and be excited and hopeful that things are going to change for the better because of this agreement that the United States negotiates with you. And then a couple of years later, a different president in the United States basically just unilaterally pulls out of that deal, reneges on it. And as it says here in this New York Times article, France, Germany, and Britain remained in the deal with Iran. I mean, I think eventually Iran sort of violated the terms of the deal once the deal had already been broken by the United States. And then there was a lot of huffing and puffing in the United States about Iran's moves towards their nuclear programs. But at that point, the United States had already broken the deal. So it's easy for me, I've never been to Iran, but it's easy for me to imagine what that might feel like or how that might seem from the position of a person in Iran. But that thought experiment is completely escapes the hosts of the New Yorker political scene. On now to a discussion about what's happening with the war in Ukraine.
We met recently with Anatoly Chubais, who is one of the most polarizing and important figures in kind of Russia's transition from the Soviet Union. He was the architect of the much-hated privatization in Russia of many of these companies. You could say he was sort of one of the creators of this oligarchic capitalist system. He's left Russia because of the war in Ukraine. At the same time, what he was most profoundly shaken by, Evan, was this idea that whenever this horrible war in Ukraine is over, and we can talk about that, that Russia would have mortgaged its future, would have become essentially an economic vassal of China. And that's what he was talking about on this visit.
First of all, Susan Glasser says here, we met recently with Anatoly Chubais. I don't know who the we she's talking about refers to. Did she have a mouse in her pocket? I don't think she means her and the other two hosts of the political scene. My guess is she probably means her and her husband, who Peter Baker, who writes for the New York Times. More on him in a minute. So, yeah, like, it's unclear if she's meeting with this Russian oligarch for an interview, for a story, or what exactly is going on. And also it's kind of just funny. It's like she just says the word we, and one is left to wonder who the we is. Second of all, Susan Glasser, who lived for years in Russia, seemingly lacks the context of people from the global south and other countries who for decades have dealt with the fact that their countries are mortgaged, quote unquote, to creditors like the IMF, like the World Bank, like the European Union, like vulture funds in the United States. So this issue of Russia having mortgaged their future to China in order to fight this war in Ukraine, I mean, it's unfortunate, and you wouldn't find me defending Russia's war in Ukraine, but this issue of you know, a Russian oligarch feeling sad that his country has mortgaged its future to a creditor like China. I mean, you do not have to look very far to find people in the global south, countries in the global south, who've also mortgaged their futures to Western creditors. Again, none of that context would be provided here in the political scene, but I think it's worth mentioning and it's worth considering the sort of framework of all of these issues that's the basis of this episode, which focuses on the fact that Vladimir Putin and his family are learning Russian, is that Russia is turning to China because of its economic power and what that says basically about like the future of, you know, global superpowers and their alignments. But yeah, it's worth considering whether China isn't simply replacing the role that's historically been played by the United States, even going back to what we were talking about or what I was talking about earlier regarding the United States basically injecting a bunch of money into the International Monetary Fund in order to offer zero interest loans to countries like Kenya in exchange for Kenya sending its police to Haiti. A lot of the times, political crises all over the world have been sparked by the fact that sometimes those loans, regardless of the interest rate, have other conditions like austerity. So this is a sort of context here that I think is worth injecting into this conversation.
One of the restrictions that Ukrainians have been very frustrated with from the United States from the very beginning of the war is that we're supplying billions and billions of dollars of weapons. Ukraine could not keep fighting, to be clear, without them. But at the same time, we've imposed this condition that we're not to use those weapons to strike inside of Russia. Well, Russia is so close to the border with Kharkiv that that is almost a crippling kind of liability. So you're seeing a big internal debate playing out right now in Washington.
So the reason why those restrictions have been put in place, according to the Biden administration, is to prevent an escalation and the potential retaliation of Russia towards the United States or other NATO allies, which could effectively lead to World War III, where global nuclear superpowers would be in direct military conflict with each other. So it's understandable why the Ukrainians would want to be able to attack Russian military targets inside Russia, but there's a broader geopolitical reason and interest why the Biden administration doesn't want to be seen as being party to military strikes on Russian soil. That's why they also have distanced themselves from drone strikes that have happened inside of Russia. So there's a lot. Again, the lens here for this analysis about whether the United States should be providing weapons to Ukraine that it knows are going to be used inside of Russian territory, it just, I think it would be helpful for the listeners of the political scene to know a little bit more about why it is the United States isn't providing those weapons, or why there's conditions on the weapons that are being provided. So remember earlier in the podcast when Jane Mayer said that this presidential election campaign season hasn't provided much discussion about foreign policy? Now they're going to basically just contradict that point by talking about the disparity that's emerged between Donald Trump and Joe Biden's positions on Ukraine and Russia. Here's Evan Osnos.
We're getting a very clear sign already of how different the world could look under a Trump presidency when it comes to Ukraine. Trump has been saying, of course, all along, what he could do is get a resolution to the war in 24 hours. So how do you do that? Well, the way you do that, to be blunt about it, is you give Russia everything it wants. You basically reward them for what they have stolen and attacked. And I think there is becoming a clearer and clearer sense that that is, in fact, what a Trump policy could look like, and that a quote-unquote ceasefire would be, in effect, handing Vladimir Putin the territory that he has taken in Ukraine and I think this is important to point out, signaling to China and other powers that might makes right.
So remember Rudy, who's like 5'2", he tried out for Notre Dame, and everyone just sort of took a liking to him, so they let him be on the practice squad, and he sat on the bench, and then when the big game came around at the end of the season, everyone loved him so much, they decided to put him in. And despite the odds against him, and despite the fact that he's just this little guy, he was able to go get a sack. And everyone cheered, and his dad cried, and everyone cried, and it was super inspirational. I kind of feel like that's what Ukraine was like 2 years ago, after the war started, and they were able to, despite the fact that Russia had a much more powerful military, they were able to put up this super admirable resistance. And so everyone in the West was like, these are the good guys. And is this like sort of inspiring story everyone wanted to get behind and somehow be a part of. Imagine now if it was like Rudy 4 and he's playing in, I don't know, like the Philippines has a football league, and he's there, still playing, and has had maybe like a dozen or so concussions, and, you know, he's all banged up, and everyone still loves him. And at a certain point, you kind of hope that someone pulls him aside and says, like, hey, man, you made a very valiant run of it, and despite the odds against you, you overcame a bunch of adversity. And we all love you, but it's probably time to hang up the cleats. You're getting older. You're pretty banged up as it is. I kind of feel like that's where things are now with Ukraine. It's like, you know, they're having a hard time recruiting soldiers. Support domestically in the United States for the war in Ukraine is fickle for a number of reasons. And it just doesn't seem like it's the case that in the foreseeable future, Ukraine is going to be able to push Russia back across the border of the territories that Russia currently occupies. So I understand for someone like Evan Osnos, it's super distasteful to think that a United States president would like advocate for Ukraine to make concessions to Russia, a negotiated settlement. But it does seem like eventually that's going to be in the cards. And the longer that passes without that taking place, the more Ukrainians that are going to die, and maybe the more territory that Ukraine could lose to Russia.
Trump's predilection for Vladimir Putin and for other authoritarians like Xi Jinping, it's been, I would say it's one of the ways in which Trump is the most un-American of our leaders. Really, there's no president I can ever imagine who has had such a consistent predilection for America's adversaries while at the same time denigrating America's allies. And I think that what you would see in another Trump term would be kind of that policy on steroids. Now, as far as the war in Ukraine goes, what you're looking at is, I think Evan's right, a kind of a land for peace arrangement that, by the way, Ukraine would not go along with. So this idea is a fallacy. And I think it's really important because I hear this from Americans all the time.
When you say Ukraine wouldn't go along with it, what are its options?
They will keep fighting, Jane.
They will keep fighting, she says. They will keep fighting, Jane. Look, it's a romantic idea, and American liberals who back the Ukrainian cause love this idea of Ukrainians persisting until they're ultimately victorious because it's a beautiful idea. And, of course, I think Russia was wrong to invade Ukraine. Ukraine has every reason to fight against Russia to defend itself. Don't get me wrong. I totally support them in their cause, but it's important to consider the context and the reality of the situation, which is that without a steady supply of U.S. weapons, they're not going to be able to continue fighting at a certain point. That's just the truth. And Zelensky is not an idiot. He's fighting this war with the idea that he has the support of the world's biggest military superpower in the United States. But if the liberals in Washington are going to be actual friends to him and the people of Ukraine, they should also be urging him to make a deal now when he's potentially in a stronger position than he may be in a year or 2 years, especially if Donald Trump becomes president. That would save Ukrainian lives. It would prevent Ukraine from being overwhelmed militarily by Russia, which is what could happen if Ukraine were to keep fighting, as Susan Glasser says, without any U.S. military support.
And not to bring us too far down the doom loop here, but it's not just Europe. I mean, we are talking about this right at the moment that China is conducting military exercises around Taiwan, which is and for the first time, they're involving their Coast Guard in it, which is a significant. These are these kinds of little incremental steps that are important to take note of. What it means is that they are signaling, OK, this is what we could do in the event of what they are describing as this is an exercise to demonstrate its ability to, quote, seize power. So they're not being very subtle about it. The reason why it matters is, what is preventing China from going into Taiwan? A big piece of it is deterrence from the United States. And if you have an incoming American president, conceivably, who is signaling quite audibly that he is willing to allow a big power to go in and do what it wants, that is a message that is read and heard very clearly. These are not abstractions.
And very much the opposite message that Biden has sent by supporting Ukraine. In case there's any doubt on this, people should listen to the speech that Trump gave just this week in the South Bronx.
When you see President Xi of China, when you see Kim Jong-un of North Korea, when you see Putin and you see all of these people, they're at the top of their game, whether you like it or not, and they can't believe that this has happened to the United States. We have lost respect all over the world.
He basically name checks, calls out, and admires the dictators of the world. And it's absolutely clear that I think he'd be the first president of the United States that doesn't value democracy.
I mean, that's just ridiculous on its face. If you know anything about modern history and all of the anti-democratic coups that the United States has been behind to overthrow democratically elected leaders, including in almost all of the countries being discussed here, Iran and Russia and Haiti, and, I mean, like every country in Latin America, right? So the idea that Donald Trump would be somehow the first U.S. president to not respect democracy is just an insane thing for someone to say. Of course, not to mention the fact all of the U.S. presidents who governed over a country that where you could own other human beings, or where like half of the population or more than half of the population can't vote because of their gender or because of their race. Yeah, just a crazy, like, lib-brained thing to say, honestly. And then in terms of China and what Evan Osnos is saying about U.S. deterrence as it pertains to Taiwan and China potentially, like, invading Taiwan, I mean, first of all, the official U.S. policy is the One China policy, as it's called, which means the United States does not recognize the sovereignty of Taiwan. So yeah, it's a little confusing, and in fact, intentionally confusing, what the actual U.S. position is, regarding Taiwan. In fact, the strategy is called strategic ambiguity. That's what it's, that's like its official title. That's how it's officially described. The idea being that the U.S. policy towards Taiwan be ambiguous enough that based on what's most strategically advantageous, the United States can sort of lean in one direction or another, recognizing Taiwan as a sort of like autonomous region, or placating China and sort of admitting or acknowledging that Taiwan is in fact a part of China. You know, I don't know that much about Taiwan. I don't know that much about the politics of China. From what I can discern from official U.S. policy, the United States has sat on the fence about this issue for decades. So, yeah, I would be very hard pressed to look young men and women in the eye and tell them that you need to go fight and potentially die in the South China Sea to prevent China from sending its military to an island that the United States kind of recognizes as a part of China. Yeah, again, I'm sure there's people who are much more well-versed on Taiwan and the politics of Taiwan than I am. But suffice to say, I'd have a very hard time justifying why tens of thousands of Americans should die for that cause. So now the conversation shifts back to Russia, mainly the way that Donald Trump has been discussing how, if he's elected, he would immediately negotiate the release of the Wall Street Journal reporter who's being held in Russia.
And this week he had an incredible Truth Social, Evan, and I don't know what you make of this, in which he's bragging that he has such a great relationship with Vladimir Putin that he's going to release the unjustly imprisoned Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich as soon as Trump is elected. Now, I read that and I thought
it was
obscene. Disgusting. First of all, it's anti-American. The idea, if he has such a great relationship with Putin, then why the heck isn't he doing everything he can to get him out now? But it's practically inviting Putin to keep this reporter a hostage until our election.
So if a presidential candidate is incentivizing foreign countries to hold U.S. detainees or hostages longer than is needed for political reasons, would that be anti-American? If you want to know the answer, you should ask Ronald Reagan. I guess he's dead, but dig him up and then ask him. So here's a fun fact. Our very own Susan Glasser is married to Peter Baker, who is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. And on March 18th of last year, He published this story, a really incredible story, headlined, A Four-Decade Secret, One Man's Story of Sabotaging Carter's Re-Election. This is Susan Glasser's husband writing in the New York Times. It has been more than four decades, but Ben Barnes said he remembers it vividly. His longtime political mentor invited him on a mission to the Middle East. What Mr. Barnes said he did not realize until later was the real purpose of the mission, to sabotage the re-election campaign of the President of the United States. It was 1980 and Jimmy Carter was in the White House, bedeviled by a hostage crisis in Iran that had paralyzed his presidency and hampered his effort to win a second term. Mr. Carter's best chance for victory was to free the 52 Americans held captive before Election Day. That was something that Mr. Barnes said his mentor was determined to prevent. So, according to Barnes, Mr. Connolly, quote, took him to one Middle Eastern capital after another that summer, meeting with a host of regional leaders to deliver a blunt message to be passed to Iran. Don't release the hostages before the election. Mr. Reagan will win and give you a better deal. Then, shortly after returning home, Mr. Barnes said, Connolly reported to William J. Casey, the chairman of Mr. Reagan's campaign and later director of the CIA, briefing him about the trip in an airport lounge. With Mr. Carter, now 98 and in hospice care, Jimmy Carter is now 99, still in hospice care, Mr. Barnes said he felt compelled to come forward to correct the record. Quote, history needs to know that this happened, Mr. Barnes, who turns 85 next month, said in one of several interviews, his first with news organizations, about the episode. I think it's so significant, and I guess knowing that the end is near for President Carter put it on my mind more and more and more. I just feel like we've got to get it down some way. So basically, what this article says is that Ronald Reagan's campaign was going around the Middle East in an effort to convey to the revolutionary government of Iran that they should not release the American hostages until after Ronald Reagan beat the then current president, Jimmy Carter, in the presidential election. Donald Trump is going on the campaign trail now, saying that if he's elected, he would negotiate the release of this Wall Street Journal reporter. And the host of the New Yorker political scene call this un-American. But I have a question for you. Is there anyone more American than Ronald Reagan? The hosts of the political scene, Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, and Evan Osnos, whether they sort of understand it or not, like what sort of underlines all of their analysis and opinion is American exceptionalism. So the idea that a presidential candidate, in this case Donald Trump, would say or do something that would potentially prolong the detention of this U.S. person, this reporter who's being held in Russia, the idea that an American presidential candidate would do anything to prolong that is simply un-American. But actually, what I think is it's as American as apple pie. It's as American as Ronald Reagan. Honestly, what is more American than Ronald Reagan? This is the way that American leaders conduct themselves. It's the way that America conducts itself. It's ugly, it's nasty, it's unethical, it's immoral, and it's American, baby.
Traditionally, it's not that often that foreign policy is a top issue in American presidential campaigns.
We've already been over this, Jane.
Usually it sort of pops up as a question of, you know, which one of these people would be able to handle a nuclear crisis. You know, there's the red phone ads and all of that sort of thing. But this is an unusual situation where you have basically two incumbents. So you can't really play that card quite as well.
When the red phone rings for Donald Trump at 3 a.m., he'll still be up tweeting.
Oh, they're so funny. Listen, that's the end of the first episode of the New Yorker political scene. If you enjoyed this or if you just got through it somehow, please subscribe and like us and write a review. I promise this podcast will get better as I do it more and more, that's my promise to you. So stick with it. I'm going to stick with it. And hopefully we will not go completely insane between now and November. I love you all.